Campus FM presents a talk in the Work in Progress seminar series entitled Cookery Books and Maltese National Ideology. This talk is delivered by Elise Billard, lecturer in material culture in the Anthropology Division and PhD candidate at University of Provence.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Good evening, radio audience. Welcome to the last in our scheduled seminar in the series Work in Progress in the Social Studies for this academic year. If we have any further special seminars this spring or summer, we will be letting you know through the online announcements of the university or through our email list. Tonight it gives me great pleasure to welcome Ms. Elise Billard Pisani. Elise lectures in material culture in the Anthropology Division of the University of Malta. She is also a doctoral student of the University of Aix-Marseille, where she is writing her doctoral dissertation on the subject Maltese food and Maltese national identity. Well, some of you will have seen her the notice for her seminar tonight, which is fairly provocative. In this notice, she wrote that cookery books can become powerful tools for promoting a national ideology. And in this paper, Ms. Billard Pisani seeks to demonstrate how popular gastronomy can become a subject of national pride, and how also a large number of cookery books in Malta have constructed a particular image of Maltese food. So without further ado, we hand over to you, Elise.
Thank you, Paul. So as Paul was saying, today I'm going to read a bit about what I'm writing. I'm writing the last chapter of my PhD, because I wrote before about practices, and now I finished the thesis with this course. All of you know what are culinary practices in Malta, so I don't need to tell you. So, it is commonly admitted that all nations have their own cuisine. For example, people are told that they are French because they like to eat a croissant in the morning. Food is part of what can be called banal nationalism. In this perspective, nationalism is seen as a feeling of belonging that is objectified in domestic objects such as food. Today I wish to go through the cookery books of Malta with a national perspective. I argue with Apadurai that cookery books belong to the humble literature of complex civilizations. Cookery books do not only reflect the boundaries of edibility, but also reflect the structure of domestic ideologies. That's an example. Nations are based on a common heritage and not on a simple citizenship. Nation states need to create an imagined community, the illusion of a homogeneous group. The patriotism takes its imagery from the family, where women have a fundamental role to create bonds between individuals. While men protect women and children, women represent the mother of the nation. While men stand for the modern national symbols such as the flag, the memorials, the army, women, on the other side, are the depositories of traditions. This explains why women have to keep up with their mother's cuisine and why men have to keep up with modernity. Women's world is seen as the refuge of all traditions that should never be lost. In reality, women are as much the agents of change as are men. Apadurai shown, for instance, how in India women mix different regional cuisines and created the national Indian cuisine. Today we shall see how the cookery books in Malta have dealt with this paradoxical mission, preserving old recipes and creating a homogeneous national cuisine. We shall see how cookery books are a window for promoting Maltese national identity. We will not describe what Maltese eat and cook, but what image of Malta is created through cookery books. For this purpose, I will only use the cookery books which are tourist-oriented. Yes. Even if most of them also aim to give to the Maltese themselves an idea of what their food heritage should be. I will use the term traditional Maltese food to refer to the commonly accepted Maltese recipes. As we will see, this has nothing to do with what is cooked and eaten in the Maltese island. The Maltese cookery books present a particular kind of food, which can be characterized by its familial orientation, its traditional origin, its nostalgia, and its constant reference to the Mediterranean. The first characteristic of the traditional Maltese food is its low-class aspect. Maltese cookery books are not about the bourgeois haute cuisine that can be found in some exclusive Maltese restaurants or in the kitchen of the elite of the nation. Maltese cookery books are about low-cost family dishes. True?
Yes.
How nice. She looks like you. Pages are dedicated to huge portions of rice cooked in the oven, which could feed a family for only €3. So the timpana, torta, talampuki, rossiforn. They explain with pride the way to make a sandwich, which is privileged to have been given a name, Habsbizet, and the basic vegetable soup called minestra is to be found with its many variations in all cookery books, notably the Sopata Lamla, which implies the poverty of the widow. The readers do not discover an expensive haute cuisine in the way the Japanese promoted their elitist sushi. The traditional Maltese food is anything but what Goody has defined as haute cuisine, a cuisine for the elite, using exotic and expensive ingredients, prepared by professional cooks with complex techniques, innovative dishes, and a special care for presentation. The authors of Maltese cookery books do not pretend to use exotic or expensive ingredients, on the complete opposite. Fish in cans are used for the fish pie, and stock cubes are added to give flavor. In some more purist cookery books, fresh ingredients are a must, but there again, all the ingredients have to be local and seasonal, nothing exotic. Moreover, no specific knowledge is necessary to cook these recipes. For instance, when meat is mentioned, a particular cut is not specified. One simply refers to pork, beef, poultry, whatever. The dishes promoted are made by modest housewives, like your mother. No? Modest housewives and not by reputed chefs. The photographs of the cookery books confirm this popular image of the traditional Maltese food. Earthen pots, old kenur, and Czech tablecloths are displayed to evoke a country cuisine. We can safely state that the authors of these cookery books consider their national food to be a popular one. The value and respect of the cuisine do not come from individual creativity, but from its traditional quality. The recipes are considered traditional because they are being transmitted from grandmother to mothers and finally to the authors. This family origin gives all the value to the recipes presented in the cookery books. Some recipes are given in a storytelling way. This one, for example. In this example, taken from Cremona's beautiful book, the minestra becomes a part of the daily life of Tourache Cambry. So this is doesn't look like a recipe, but it's just to show the family origin of it, the proximity. Tradition is associated to fashionable concepts of authenticity and genuinity. It seems that the authors are telling to the tourists, this is our true cuisine, this is our real cuisine. The fact that all the authors claim to have received their recipes from their mother or their relatives is at the very core of their legitimacy. It is their oral transmission from generation to generation and never beyond the limits of women's world, the kitchen, that give its flavor of purity. Tradition here is highly associated with the world of women, a world where the Maltese identity has found its refuge. Its refuge. All right. Authors are trying their best to recreate the friendly and oral moment of cooking, like here. Unfortunately, there is something that writing cannot do. Describe the body knowledge and the personal relations that are engaged in food processes. This is a paradox at the core of all nostalgic cookbooks. Cookery books preserve as much as they transform and kill. Written recipes are far from being simple transcriptions of the complex decisions that are being taken by the housewives or the men of the family. But I take the housewife today, because it's still the majority. While she's cooking, a good cook thinks ahead from her shopping, adapts her decisions to what is available on the greengrocer counter and at the best price. She thinks of what her grandson would like to eat. He's so anxious with his exams. She thinks that she won't have much time because she has to go to a wedding at 6. Once in her kitchen, she weighs with her hands the rice and adds a bit more butter because her grandson loves it. And today, she decided to make aliotta because her cat has been craving for fish bones. As we can see, cooking is not a pure technique that can be applied any day. Giard has shown how many skills are necessary to convert a dry recipe description into a good dish. This is what cookery books cannot describe. Moreover, I argue that writing in itself is a death sentence. As Clifford suggests, writing implies either distance or death, or both. Just as the embodied learning of recipes implies identity. Literacy, in Western symbolism, represents the enduring but inauthentic. By contrast, spoken words are transient and authentic. This is the reason why oral transmission is so important for the authors. But this is also the reason why by writing oral and embodied techniques, the authors are killing them, since they are distinguishing the cook from its culinary knowledge. The recipes once written become impersonal, collective, and almost eternal. The culinary techniques once written are fixed and flat, and therefore they can be considered dead. Nonetheless, written recipes preserve the skeletal ingredients and methods and allow us to recreate with some approximations, recipes which could have otherwise been lost. But even at the individual level, writing recipes down has the power to kill, as an informant once told me. If you write all my cookery tricks, then I can just die. Indeed, some women still refuse to write down their recipes, as it is for them a powerful tool. They like to be the family's sole source of perfect food. If someone wants to know their culinary secrets, he has to learn them by heart, writing them with his body. Cooking is a competitive activity among women, with secrets closely guarded. Cooking knowledge equals power, which explains why sometimes cooks give their name to recipes. The paradox presented by these nostalgic cookbooks is that what they are nostalgically longing for, the oral community and all the embodied knowledge that comes with it, is being preserved through writing and, in the most commodified form, the mass market cookbook. Mm-hmm. The term traditional is highly problematic here. Commonly, tradition refers to oral customs. However, we can wonder if once written down, recipes are still traditional. If they were traditional, they would not need to be written, wouldn't they? There are no fixed traditions. The only fixed traditions put down on paper are dead. The core of a tradition is its transmission from generation to generation. Through speaking, observation, and imitation, techniques and skills, as well as a general knowledge, are being passed from mothers to daughters. Along this process, the recipes are being translated, for the simple reason that daughters are different from their mother. And after all, there is invention in any learning, as much as there is learning in any invention. Tradition should be considered as an innovative phenomenon, and not only as relics of the past. Can you read a bit? All right. Going back to our traditional Maltese food, the first duty of the researcher is to confirm the age of the recipes. Are these recipes old? As we can see, the traditional Maltese cuisine is a strict selection of recipes that can be found again and again. Timpana, imarun, rosilforn, aliotta, sopa tallarmla, raviol, minestra, bragioli, caolata, tortata lircotta, tortata lampucchi, zarmimli, fencata, etc. And of course, imaret, pastizzi, figoli, prignolata, etc. This list of recipes is also to be found in a book dating of the very end of the 19th century. The enigmatic author Vela ELV gives a long list of more than 100 recipes, where the majority of the typical ones are present. So, for example, he lists brodo semplici, sopa tal demb, sopa tal piselli, sopa magra tal amla, caolata, minestra tal hashish, purea fazola, which seems to refer to bigilla, raviol, barbugliata, bragioli, and timpana, among others. The almost perfect resemblance between the modern cookery books and this old one would easily lead a cynical mind to conclude that food amateurs have been copying their recipes from it. However, if Vela's book has surely influenced today's list of traditional recipes, the many variations of the same recipe found in today's cookery books invalidate this suspicion. The recipes have, without doubt, been transmitted through generations and have been adapted and transformed along the way. However, some recipes have not been listed in today's Maltese cookery books, some of the recipes of Vella. Most of these forgotten recipes have a clear foreign title, which became suspicious for food lovers who were trying to distinguish their national cuisine. Irish stew, bœuf à la mode, and even cottage pie. One can suggest that in the selection of traditional Maltese recipes, there has been a purification. The example of Bait Moshe shows not only the evolution of the culinary Maltese language, but also the strong influence that the European bourgeois food culture has had on the island. You can copy it if you want. So as you can see, this is a very old, which predates the Maltese alphabet. However, are these old recipes still cooked and appreciated by the Maltese? And have the new popular recipes been listed alongside the old ones? In other words, if cookery books are featuring Maltese food, why is there no mention of ham and cheese sandwich next to the emblematic Hobbs Bizet? Why is horse meat decidedly absent? Why does chutney have no place in these books? Why is Worcestershire sauce nowhere to be found? Why is trifle, a dessert that many of my informants refer to as the national dessert, conspicuous by its absence, and the cottage pie, and the pizza, and the delicious koshat al haruf il forn, and the pheasant casserole? The list is long. The answer is to be found in the introduction of the books and in the magazines where the defenders of traditional Maltese food are submitting their ideas. According to them, the concept of authentic and truth are not to be associated with what common people are eating nowadays. Spoiled by globalization and industrialization, the food that is eaten in Malta and cooked by Maltese today is not considered to be the real Maltese food. On the contrary, what Maltese actually consume is sadly overshadowing the true recipes. Cookery books are here the tools in the postmodernist fight against the unavoidable erosion of time. We could even classify the work of the authors as what Clifford has called salvage ethnography, which is the description of customs on the verge of disappearing. The nostalgia in Malta can be defined with what Rosaldo has called imperialist nostalgia, that is, I quote him, a romantic nostalgia for words that modern people have destroyed in the processes of modernization, urbanization, and industrialization. So some examples of photos that can be found in nowadays cookery books that are now being sold. So you see quite an old one. Again, the reenactment of the famous Kenor and the Czech tablecloth. Very fashionable, earthen pots. Indeed, the traditional Maltese food is largely a rural cuisine. For the most urbanized country in Europe, this could come as a surprise. How can Maltese food be defined as rural in a country where there is almost no countryside? Almost. How can Maltese cook with local ingredients when the country has always depended heavily on imports? It is nonetheless how Maltese recipes are illustrated. These are taken from Matti Cremona's book. So you see all of it. I mean, the book is called A Year in the Country, so fair enough. This is another one. So it is nonetheless how Maltese recipes are illustrated. The book of Matti Cremona is the perfect illustration of this romantic idea of Malta. The book, A Year in the Country, is lavishly illustrated, garnished with stories and notes about life in the countryside. A world far from modernity, where farmers would eat only local produces, vegetable soups, sun-dried tomatoes, and obviously olive oil, olive in brine, fried olives, etc. This book is one of the favorite Maltese cookery books and one that is considered representing the real Maltese food. To be fair, I want to note that the author is fortunately writing her next book on Maltese urban food. This would come as a fresh contribution to balance the rural idea of Malta. The image of a romantic Malta is not recent, as Paul Sancassia has shown in his analysis of the 19th century paintings. Paintings of the 19th century emphasized the exotic and oriental aspects of the Maltese nature, seen as the quintessence of the Maltese islands. Here I quote him. "The exotic, the oriental, is now paradoxically imagined to be at home, but as far away from home possible, in the pre-industrial countryside. So complete has this process been that few paintings are peopled. Instead, there is landscape, admittedly pretty, but literally lacking people and life, the most vibrant aspect of any culture." Here you have an example. The same imagery can be found in cookery books and other tourist brochures. Again, I quote Sancassia. "Indeed, the image of Malta that emerges is not that far removed from the images peddled in contemporary tourist literature." The romantic idea of Malta is not only associated with rurality in general, but more deeply with a kind of orientalism, or more precisely, to what is nowadays called Mediterraneanism. The term is an adaptation of what Edward Said called Orientalism. Orientalism refers to the description in European literature of a picturesque Orient. Interestingly, the Oriental woman's word is also the point of great interest by European authors, in the same way that today domestic food is the place of Maltese nationalist nostalgia. So again, woman's word. Nowadays, this romantic idea of the Orient is used by Oriental people themselves to qualify their culture, in the same way that people from Mediterranean societies use colonial stereotypes to qualify their own culture. When speaking about the Mediterranean, food always comes to mind. The Mediterranean diet is one of the pillars of Mediterraneanism. Nowadays, it has been developed and promoted in thousands of cookery books and in thousands of medical posters. Discovered by American scientists led by Ansel Keys, the Mediterranean diet is centrally based on the Cretan diet, Greece. Looking for the reason that could explain an exceptional low rate of cardiovascular diseases in some Mediterranean societies in the 1940s and 1950s, Western medicine, obsessed by obesity, has welcomed Key's findings. The Cretan diet then passed through a process of schematization to come out in the form of a dietetic pyramid where vegetables and cereals were the main food. Sadly, for the nostalgic Mediterranean lovers. The Mediterranean societies are now among the top societies with a high rate of overweight people. Malta is no exception. The healthy aspect of the traditional Maltese food is becoming more and more important. Recipes previously made with animal fats, shaham, were until recently made with margarine. It was a temporary solution to the low-fat concern. But today, this industrial product has to be replaced by an emblem of the Mediterranean healthy food, olive oil. Unfortunately, in the Maltese kitchen, olive oil has slowly disappeared around 1,000 years ago. It can therefore be considered as a recent innovation in contemporary Maltese food. The idealization of traditional Maltese food imposes some compromises with reality. This is because Mediterranean diet does not only answer to the anxiety of modern and overweight individuals. It is not only a healthy guidebook for diet. It gives more than medical instructions. Nowadays, the Mediterranean diet is the depository of a picturesque past that is slowly disappearing. The Mediterranean diet, with its local vegetables, its folklore of simmering pots and smiling old faces, fits perfectly in the idealization of the rural and backward Mediterranean where time stood still. This postmodernist nostalgia can only be understood if one considers the modern conception of time. In the modern constitution, as Latour has brilliantly explained, time is seen as an ascending line where the past is lost for eternity. If generally past is associated with backwardness, the nostalgic food amateurs consider the past to be the refuge of Malteseness. Modern Maltese food practices are not really Maltese. So far from abolishing the linearity of time, the nostalgics are just reversing it. I argue that the reality is far more complex. What an honest observer of Maltese food practices will see is a mix of old ingredients and new ones, such as a teaspoon of instant coffee in the tomato sauce. And listening to his informants, he will understand that everything makes sense. He will see that there is Worcester sauce in the minestra because the doctor prescribed a no-salt diet. The Maltese have no problem adapting their practice towards what they consider the best solutions. However, this is not what the authors of cookery books are promoting. Their idealization of traditional Maltese food follows the trend for past food traditions, which has led to rediscover numerous food products that were previously considered as backward, such as, for example, the conserva sold in tourist shop by Savinas in a designer package. And I won't tell you the price of it. Much has been written on this topic. In the Greek context, for example, Gefou Madianou describes the historical shift by which Retsina, wine-producing villagers, went from being labeled as backward peasants and drunkards by elites in Athens to being considered one of the bearers of authentic Greek folk tradition in recent times. In a country where whiskey has long been the drink of high status, Retsina has acquired a new cachet and has been identified as the characteristic Greek wine. We could easily apply the same analysis to the commodification of the Maltese house wines or diftira made in Nadur bakery that are now sold to tourists and in Arcadia supermarket. We are now able to see that nostalgia is a social class discourse of distinction. It is the urban elite who is looking with a nostalgic romantic eye to its popular rural counterpart. While the people who belong to the lowest classes of Malta are still heading towards progress and modernity, towards the great imports that industrialization and globalization have been recently offering. This is the postmodern paradox, where the most modernized people are looking upon the picturesque past. The example of the slow food movement gives another example of this postmodernist perspective. Leach, in her discussion of the slow food movement in Italy, describes the phenomenon of Tuscanopia, in which Tuscan peasant cuisines and picturesque reality seem to have become key fantasies, spaces of modern urban alienation. I'm quoting Leach. Moreover, we can argue that this nostalgic idealization of Maltese food follows the Mediterraneanist imagery, an imagery made by dominant colonizers on their submissive colonies. In this perspective, traditional Maltese food becomes a view from the outside. It becomes the nostalgic view of the dominant societies, namely European, on semi-peripheral societies, such as Malta. Again, I quote Paul Sankasian. He explains that part of the problem is probably due to the fact that in societies made semi-peripheral by many years of colonialism, the outside view is seen as necessarily better, more potent than the internal one. In Malta, the distinction Tabara-Tajewa can explain the nostalgic view that the authors of the cookery books are reproducing on their own food culture. In a nutshell, we can say that they prefer to be inverted tourists in their own land. The paradox of the defenders of Maltese food is that they claim to preserve popular food while they reconstruct a new cuisine. So to conclude, this is the end. To conclude, I would like to insist that I'm far from criticizing the fact that Maltese food amateurs are reinventing their culinary traditions. When Husband and Ranger wrote their famous book on invented traditions, showing that some national emblematic traditions, such as, for example, the Scottish kilt, were complete recent inventions, they forgot to say that this was the case everywhere. As Hirschfeld summed up, all histories are invented. History is the way individuals look at their ancestors' time. It is not the way the ancestors were living and thinking. This is how we see them. Nations find their legitimacy by creating the illusion of a common history and tradition. In Malta, like everywhere else. And mundane objects, like cookery books, do participate to this attempt to build an idealized national Maltese identity. I do not agree with the view of some anthropologists, according to whom the new African folklore, for instance, is a decadence because it is an invented heritage. Marshall Salins, with his usual irony, noted the irreversibility of these discourses. He argues that when in the 15th and 16th centuries, Europeans invented their traditions, when they started decorating their Christian churches with the facades of classic temples. It was, and still is considered, a genuine rebirth, the beginning of a progressive future, the Renaissance. But when other people do it, it is a sign of decadence, a factitious recuperation. And to conclude, as Salins wrote, what else can one say about it, except that some people have all the historical luck? That's it.
Thank you very much, Elise. I'm sure that there'll be a number of questions from the audience as to your argument. May I just open up with a question? Would you say that cookbooks which are being produced today in Malta are full of the same nostalgia, that they are trying to reinvent these old but medically healthy recipes?
I mean, there is a historical progression, that's for sure. So, for example, nowadays, olive oil is becoming the fat to be used, whereas before, butter and margarine were more spread. So, yes, there is a progression. And I would also say that there is a big difference between tourist-oriented cookery books and Carmen Tedesco, for example, cookery books, which are more oriented towards the, let's say, common housewives, who are taking care of their family, the health of their family, and trying to introduce innovative, actually, recipes. So yes, there is a big difference. But it's not written by the same person, and it's not oriented toward the same audience.
Well, let me just ask a supplementary question there. In an article you wrote, you said that there's not just a question of recalling a past which maybe did not exist, but also I think you said that quite a bit of contemporary Maltese cuisine involves a drawing in of other parts of the Mediterranean towards the Mediterranean diet, that mm-hmm. this in no sense is historically authentic. It's really part of a pan-Mediterranean move towards some kind of mm-hmm. identity.
Mm-hmm. I mean, for sure, Malta is not the only place where people are transforming their heritage to be like we imagine Mediterranean. Yes, and I also, in this article, I remember also explaining that there is, again, a class distinction. Because if for some authors, like Matti Cremona, for example, or Julian Zammut, to be considered Mediterranean is very good. It's very fashionable. It distinguishes yourself from the colonizer, from the British and all that. From another part of the Maltese population, being associated with the Arabs is really a problem. So that's it. Can you tell us the story of your mother? How she?
Yes. Well, she's in my brother's cookery book, and one of the things I was going to ask you was this, because you talk about invented heritage, mm-hmm. but I take it you mean a discursive heritage, because I don't suppose you imply invented means recipes that were not in the family.
No.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So I think that perhaps sort of if you want to take a historical perspective, it might be worth distinguishing between those cookery book authors who are passing down recipes which have been used in the families and are still being used in the families. Mm-hmm. All right. And the ones who have recently come to the scene as cookery writers. One would have to explore how much their families have actually been cooking or how they've entered the market. And perhaps mm-hmm. that would be one distinction. You make the distinction between the ones for the local market and the tourist ones. But then you give Matti's book. I don't know where you would classify that mm-hmm. or whether you actually have a classificatory framework where you've placed the mm-hmm. different texts and how you go about distinguishing mm-hmm. that. Because some of them straddle both.
Yes.
You
yes.
know, obviously, for example, in my brother's case, he wrote one in German for the tourist market, mm-hmm, the first mm-hmm. version,
yes, I see.
And then translated it into English for the local market mm-hmm. when he realized there was also a local market. Mm-hmm. But I mean, I think that it's not as... Earlier on, you also mentioned about the cuisine being simple and anyone can cook it. I don't mm-hmm. think that that... I think that that is a bit of a very a simplistic mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. statement. And if you look at some of the recipes, for example, in Anne and Helen Caruana Galizia's mm-hmm. book, or even in Matisse, mm-hmm. they are very complex and very difficult.
Yes,
I don't know mm-hmm. if you have made timpana, yes, for example.
Yes.
Even Rosfilforn, mm-hmm. a lot of people get it wrong. You know, mm-hmm. it's... I don't... I think that
yeah,
one should really...
Can I answer?
Yes.
So, yeah, it's always the problem of language, you know, yeah. to express what you actually mean. I'm far from saying that they are simple. In fact, I also quoted GR and how much you have to have a background knowledge to understand how to do them, actually. They are just like guidebooks, recipes. They cannot tell you exactly. If you never tasted and never seeing yes. someone doing a timpana, you won't make it.
No.
And the Mediterranean food are also known to be very long and very complex. What I'm saying is that, they do not belong to the elitist cuisine, which is not more complex in its techniques, but more... Like the tools would be more complex for them, more so difficult to
but
find.
But are you talking about an international elite? Because if you're talking about mm-hmm. a Maltese elite, mm-hmm. of course, a lot of them are complex because they belong to the Maltese elite, in fact.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, the perhaps, big question, you know.
The big question is that, is there in Malta a haute cuisine? There are some very good restaurants where you can find an innovative haute cuisine. There is also the book of Pippa Mattei, which tried to create an innovative
Maltese
cuisine.
The Maltese haute cuisine, I would say, was in the homes and the salons that people had. So, you know, one would have to, if you looked at Maltese history, where people would be eating certain types of food mm-hmm. and who they entertained, for example, a foreign cardinal, a bishop,
mm-hmm.
that is where you would have the haute cuisine. I mean, yes. I think it's a bit of a problem, and I'm surprised for an anthropologist not to overcome this problem, mm-hmm. that surely if you're using the word elite, you would understand the local meaning, the insider meaning of mm-hmm, elite, mm-hmm. and what a Maltese elite cuisine would be.
Yeah,
because you would have to speak to the Maltese elite to know what the elite cuisine is.
I've been speaking to the Maltese
cool.
elite.
Matti Cremona.
Not you know. Matti Cremona, for example, Nicky De Piro. Okay, he's a man, he's not cooking, but he mm-hmm. told me what kind of food was prepared during the banquet, for example, you know. So my argument is just that this kind of cuisine is not presented here. I'm sorry, it's not... This is not a haute cuisine. Rosfilforn is not an haute cuisine.
Oh, I would disagree.
I can't.
Because you would need to know the history of families and what they are presenting on certain, and different families and different...
But
and
what,
then
what
they what cook.
Argue... For example,
saffron. Do you think that saffron was available to all the groups in Maltese society, which is a basic
but
ingredient
you're speaking about
of Rosfilforn?
Now it is available. Now, I'm speaking about now. Again, we always have this bias about the past cuisine. I'm speaking, why
now.
In the cookery books now?
Yes.
We don't speak about contemporary, haute innovative cuisine. And I defined haute cuisine mm-hmm. as using exotic thing. Okay, saffron was, but it's not anymore something really exotic. And being done by innovative chefs, something very expensive, that is haute cuisine. I'm not saying that Rosfilforn is not good, far from it.
No, mm-hmm. I understand that you're
and
saying
I mean,
that.
Calamari mimli, uh-huh. for example, are really hard to do. And I don't know how to really do them. But it's not...
I'll leave it there. I still think that your sort of categories are mm-hmm. not the categories that... come from local knowledge. in the sense certain things we would consider to be haute cuisine, saffron in Rosfilforn. Mm-hmm. So in some of the cookery books, the saffron would not be included
exactly,
because
yes.
they're not, but in others, they would. And certain, you know, so I mean, I think that it might, one would need to have a look at how insiders classify.
Thank you, Alice. I quite admire the fact that a French person is braving the Maltese food world. Listening to this exchange, especially, I wonder how much this has to do with nationalism and, or with families, actually, with kinship. Mm-hmm. Because when I hear things like recipes that have been in the family, I begin to wonder. It reminds me of a little section in the Gatto Pardo, where a timpana is described. Mm-hmm. And there is almost a parallel between the timpana and all the good things, rather strange things that are to be found in the timpana, like chickens, livers, and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And the description of the family house and the family itself. So the timpana, in a sense, becomes the family. And I'm not sure this has to do very much with nationalism. I'm not talking about your cookery books.
Mm-hmm.
But this sort of discourse, recipes that have been in the family. It seems to me that it, we're talking about a sense of uniqueness and also a sense of well-being, because it was only the quote-unquote elite families that could afford certain types of ingredients,
mm-hmm.
And also a certain wholesome food mm-hmm. that was passed through the women mm-hmm. of the family, which after all were also women of leisure. They were a bit like the gentlemen of leisure who were smoking, I don't know, cigars or mm-hmm. in the club, mm-hmm. and the women were at home making the food. So they were also women of leisure. So mm-hmm. I think there is something to be said, if I may say so, with respect to what you said, to looking at the kinship part as well. I know we didn't have much time to look at everything, and of course then, as we know, kinship can become a very important aspect of nationalism, ultimately,
mm-hmm.
because you can have a sense of a few core families that represent the essence and the spirit of a nation,
mm-hmm.
a bit like Evans Pritchard's core of kinship. I wonder what your thoughts are about this, if any.
I mean, it's a very interesting point. I had not thought of it, so in previous chapters of the PhD, I wrote a lot about food being defined more as a relation in the family, as like gift exchange, you know, so more in the most perspective. Then, yes, family, as I said, you know, I mean, women are the mother of the nation, all this image of the nation being a woman, and also this thing of the true national emblems are to be found in the family, in the house, and in the kitchen. So, yes, very interesting, but... Mm-hmm. Yes, then?
I'm not sure, because I see where... I see what Mary Darmani was getting at. I think it's also rather simplistic to look to say it's a rural image. For example, Maltese furniture can be tremendously expensive. It's definitely not rural. Mm-hmm. And there's also a sense of being passed down within families. So I'm not sure. I think it's mm-hmm. a bit more complex than that.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you for that, Eliza. I mean, I think I totally agree with Mark. I think you were quite daring to stick your neck out, and yeah.
it's good.
Oh, yeah. I think I totally agree with, you know, the fact that I would suggest that there is one thing that we definitely need to clearly define here, what's traditional and what's typical.
Mm-hmm.
The 80s are definitely a remarkable period in the history of the island. I would say that, you know, amid the fact that we can take it back to thousands of years and claim that the, you know, the, mm-hmm. the Gigantea temples are older than the pyramids, and
mm-hmm.
At the end of the day, I think it's relatively a new nation as far as independence comes to,
mm-hmm.
yeah. And I would say that I totally agree with you. Most of the stuff that we're getting right now is a byproduct of this is who we are now. And if you had to ask me, you know, is there something which is typically Maltese? My answer to that is no. Because you can take it from wherever you want to take it. It's a checkered past, and I think, as any other kitchen, what we do is we just basically burrow.
I would not go that far, but...
and adapt. Yeah?
And
that's
adapt,
what we basically do. We burrow and we adapt. And I don't think that
like
we as Maltese people are unique in that, because everyone does that. So I would really think about what's traditional and what's typical, especially in the 90s with the result of the European Union, and especially with the drive that particular nations were given with PDA and, you know, this demarcation that were given to particular products, like the Danes being taken to court because they claimed that they did cheese. I mean, something as you know, it might seem ridiculous, but the Greeks said, you know, the hell with you. I mean, one big issue on the island was blood oranges. Because the Sicilians, you know, I mean, we missed the bus there, and the Sicilians claimed it, but it's... So that's why I tend to agree with you in that sense. On the other end, I mean, I myself am doing research about bread right now, and I'm specifically working on 17th century bread. And it's actually quite interesting, because if you really had to read recent newspapers, you'd find out that...
There is a lot.
There's, you know, everyone is saying... Because you said food. I'm looking at something which is really specific.
The staple food.
And, you know, we call it Hopstalmalti. I mean, well, how about that for nationalism, but at the end of the day, you know, there's a big hoo-ha about the price, the quality, but when you look at 17th century documents, you'd notice that we're rowing the same boat. The quality is down there. So in Maltese, we have a nice saying. We say, Tannanna helumanna. Which is, you know, it's my the grandma stuff is always the best. And in part, I think, you know, these recipe books are by and large a reflection of that. Coming back to Vellas, it's an
1894, exactly.
We probably is the first published recipe book that we have so far.
That's
but there are five editions of it. It keeps on going all the way to 1936.
Yes, true.
With an addition of I don't know how many. But it's quite interesting, because you're talking about the colonial period there. And Vella's introduction is claiming very clearly that this is intended for those women that work for the British people. So you had to have a knowledge of...
That's not what I have in my introduction.
Both of them.
Yeah, for the...
Most of them work with... This is what it says. It says, most of our younger women work with the British. And the Brits cannot spend time teaching our younger women how to cook. And that was the purpose of the book at the end of the day. And hence, that is why you have that elitist stuff in it. Although also in the introduction it says that it's meant for,
for
general
the common
purposes. And of course, that's a big lie. What's interesting is the point that you've remarked with the fact of how the locals have managed to take out bits and pieces from it and adapt it to what they think to be not just traditional. That's why
typically.
I take it a step forward, but actually typically Maltese.
I mean, yes, the distinction is interesting, but then, I mean... Take French food. Is there anything that we haven't borrowed from the Turks, from the Italian, from the German, whatever? You know, I mean, cuisine everywhere is a process of borrowing and adapting. It's not only Maltese. My view is, again, is the way in Maltese it is adapted and how the Maltese changed it, transformed it, that made it Maltese. But then, as you, I mean, as you noticed, as you said, every food is like that. Every culture is always constantly borrowing, constantly evolving. So if I was creating the Maltese national identity, I would not spend my time trying to make something typical, Because, I mean, the Maltese bread, is it from Rhodes or is it from France? Or you must have the answer, I suppose.
Thanks for that short presentation, Elise. It was good to hear the studies which you've undertaken. Here, I mean, I'm talking in my, so one of my extracurricular hats is for PR and communications for the Malta Chef Society.
Ah, very
and funnily enough, over the last few years, this is a question which has come up time and again when we try and either promote or want to promote real, authentic Maltese cuisine, and even when we want to distinguish between the Maltese cuisine which one found in the towns, namely the walled towns around the harbour, and the rural areas, which were distinctly different. And I think this has been made clear even here today by some of the other contributors. One thing which, you know, always worried us was the fact that, yes, this was a case of adaptation. I remember one time we tried to come up with just five traditional and authentic local dishes. It took two of us, myself and the president, about 2 hours to try and come up with these five items. And we managed to just mention one, and we weren't sure whether that was actually authentic, because they all had some sort of origin, which was either Northern Mediterranean or Southern Mediterranean. Mm-hmm. So yes, you know, the Maltese cuisine is a hybrid of Mediterranean food. It was adapted to the Mediterranean palate. And, you know, I think really when we want to promote Maltese cuisine, it's a matter of promoting the aspect of freshness and of locally grown and locally produced raw materials, I think. I think this is what really would make up a typically authentic dish in, to a certain respect.
But how do you define, yes, how do you define something authentic then?
That's why I'm saying it's the raw materials which would make it authentic. Mm. The recipe itself is an adaptation, definitely. I don't know if there's if I've opened this up to some more dialogue, if there's time.
I mean, my opinion about creating something authentic in Malta is, I think, I wish that Maltese chef could start just forgetting this thing of authenticity, you know, forgetting this thing of tradition and stuff. I mean, you are Maltese, you eat Maltese, so you have the Maltese palate or whatever. So now create with the influences as you have been doing for centuries.
This is exactly our feeling, exactly. This is why I said, really, what we try and do now is base our authenticity just on the raw materials. So if the raw materials are locally grown, then we can say, you know, this is
Then there is the problem of production in Malta, I mean.
Which is very limited.
It's very limited, and it's more and more, and has been even before, towards exportation. I mean, you see now, it's all strawberries. I mean, they are really good, but they are also for export, and tomatoes and potatoes. But then what is left
we're up against a very strong competitive market, which is international today. So, you know, it's an uphill
struggle.
But even
before, you see, the historian will tell you that even before, Maltese were dependent on Sicily for the wheat, for bread, which is really the staple food.
Yes.
And when there was a problem in Sicily, the Maltese were starving. So, again, which metaphor?
Maltese blood.
Maltese blood.
Or any other national blood. Doesn't exist, and you never find it, so forget the authentic Maltese cuisine. Doesn't mean it's not interesting as a metaphor. Unfortunately, in the case of blood, it's used for xenophobic purposes, more often than not. And even food sometimes, but I don't think we should sort of abandon the discourse, because it's an interesting discourse. It's fun. It's a bit of fun. Really.
Because you like to speak, Mark.
Yeah. I mean, why not? I mean, yeah, it's a game. It's a game, which you can say to tourists. Tourists, you know, I think many tourists are actually very much aware that they are being sold. a bit of fun, really. Tourists are, we cannot assume they're stupid. They know that, because I've spoken to tourists in Gozo, for example, where there is that little still life. I'm sure you've seen it. There's that little still life with extremely stale things that have been there since centuries out there. And tourists know that that's all. It's all being sold to you as a tourist. There's no problem with that. I mean, you know, they enjoy it. They buy into it as a sport. So,
I mean, I wish it was just a sport and people were seeing the difference between discourse and practice, you know.
Yeah, well, we have the advantage of being anthropologists.
Yeah, so maybe.
I don't think so, Mark. Because, I mean,
sorry,
what you're saying, Mark, now we're taking it to science, too. Yeah?
I mean, you've
met Matti.
Yes.
And probably her husband.
Yeah.
I mean, they've just taken samples of oil to Sicily just to measure the peppery level in it. I mean, now it's truly becoming ridiculous, yeah?
Mm.
So that's where Julian, yeah, I think that's what Julian is trying to get to. Now we're also becoming scientific, yeah, and we're claiming Inquisitor Caracciolo's 1654 letter to the Pope, and you know, saying and the
coffee.
Fruits here are really delicious, and we use that as a scientific.
No, there's something similar in literature. You know, the way national identity was created through literature, and I think many of us aren't in any way deluded by this recipe of what our national identity is. But I think as kind of analysts or academics, what we could do is, what I think would be interesting is to see why people, why, for example, our literary people chose this particular set of ingredients for their national identity. I think that's what's interesting, at least for me anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So probably it would be interesting to see, and I understand that you've done this, so to see how our national cuisine or our authentic or whatever cuisine, typical cuisine, has, how the ingredients of this cuisine have changed over time, and what makes such changes, like we're talking about, for example, local produce or probably hopefully organic produce in the near future or similar elements.
Mm-hmm. I don't know how to answer. Was there any question? Sorry. No, just to say something quick. You mentioned why people choose these, for example, three ingredients or three recipes. I think I have explained that it's to fit in this imagery of the nice Mediterranean, a bit backward, but so romantic, Malta, you know. Quaint, exactly. Which I truly disagree with. Not that I don't like olive oil and I don't like organic food, or organic has nothing to do with that. But, I mean, I do want to have a good food, but I just disagree when people say that this is the Maltese food, because in the practice, this is the main problem with identity. You have the discourse on identity and the practice. And I truly believe that there is a Maltese identity. People recognize they are Maltese. You recognize Maltese food, your Maltese accent, whatever. There is really a strong identity which has been here for a long, long, long time, centuries. But then there is the discourse. And I do think that the discourse is completely far-fetched, is not following the practices. I mean, if, as Mark was saying, it's just a game, then it's good, then it's funny.
I wouldn't separate the two myself. I wouldn't separate the discourse from the identity.
From the practice.
That's, I think, was my main point, actually.
All right.
But then what I personally find interesting is, how does our discourse, how do the changes over time in our discourse about identity reflect the time
that
produces those different
Like we are Phoenician, or we are Italian, or we are Arabic, or we are whatever.
And I think in the near future, because of our new consciousness awareness about environmental matters, for example, something which is organic, or something which is homegrown, or which doesn't have food miles in it, you know, all this stuff.
Just a comment about what you mentioned earlier with regards to identity as a as this conflict of traces which we have, this conflict between the modern and the pre-industrial. And there's always this contrast between these two, and what Mark said earlier about the same contrast between the rural and the urban. And I would like to bring it to something which is not maybe food, but actually is at the basis of to water, actually. And to the relation of the Maltese to drinking water. Because, first of all, in terms of itself, as a substance, it's neutral. So we're not speaking about whether it's exotic or whether it's haute cuisine, or it's necessary. So in that sense, it's neutral. But the relation of the population to drinking water has been changing, and it is, in a way, an indicator of the identity of the people as well. So one can go to stories which we were told when we were young, of pirates coming to shore to steal water because they needed water. So it was, that's a relation to water as something which is precious, which the island or the islands preserve and hold for the population. And then you have the construction of Valletta with the aqueduct, which leads in a way, which has to create this artificial link between the newly urbanized harbor city and the really core, the real core of the rural island.
Yes,
at the same time, even there, you have also the legal obligation for houses to have wells inside the city. So simultaneously, you have the new urban context, which depends artificially on linking it up to sources of water, but at the same time bringing in elements of rurality at the core of the city. And even more modern times, you have this issue of whether the house has a well or whether it's an apartment block, so you don't have either a tank on the roof or a well in the bottom, you know, underneath. So I think this also explains somehow Maltese relation to identity through water somehow.
So if I understood well, you want to link the rural to the urban through water?
For example, that's also, I mean, that's a different perspective, but somehow it links also to this issue of rurality and urbanity and the problem of identity.
Am I wrong? But I thought that the, how do you say, the aqueduct, wasn't linking Rabat to Valletta, so two cities basically.
It was bringing water from areas behind Dina to Valletta. It's not the construction of the aqueduct itself, because the aqueduct is an.
It's linking two cities.
It's a solution to a problem of the delivery of the water. It's the fact that the water is delivered.
I still got a bit concerned even with the question of national identity. I mean, firstly, I think that it. For me, it would be problematic to think of these cookery books as actually being a project of constructing an identity. Of course, discursively, they might end up in the eyes of tourists or even in some Maltese people as having that effect, because a discourse can act independently of the desires of its discursive agents, obviously. However, I think that you would have to make a very stronger case to say that different cookery book writers actually wanted to contribute to a project which was to construct a national identity, different from, for example, a marketing strategy, plain and simple, cashing in at a very basic level on some idea of Malta. You know, because I think that's a different project. When I compare them, for example, to the cookery book of Artusi, the Italian cookery book written after Italian unification, which was specifically to try and bring the idea of a national Italian cuisine stated as a political project. So I don't think that is the case here.
And I mean, I can answer in 2 points. I don't, from what I understand, from what you're saying, I mean, why... I understand that genuinely some Maltese authors are genuinely, yes, engaged in writing down their heritage. That's what you were saying.
No, I'm not. I mean, that's They might be doing that. What I'm saying is, whatever they're writing, even if it has the effect of contributing to an idea of a national ideology, is not necessarily what they set out to do.
Of course, no,
the project,
of course.
It was not a project of a national ideology.
No.
Also, the national ideology or the national identity is not unitary. Mm-hmm. As we know, I mean, I shouldn't think you subscribe to a unitary one. And on the contrary, I mean, if you look at the cookery books, you can really see how very much it's not unitary. It's multiple, and it reflects the social class differences very much.
I'm sorry. I really did an index of all the recipes.
Yes.
And you really see those timpana, rosifone, etc.
Oh, but if you just go by the name of the recipe, it's
yes.
But if you look at the ingredients and how they're made,
all right,
I think you could see
yes, all
quite
right.
a distinction.
Yes, that's
if
what
you
I
took
say
a
with the olive oil, for example, that some use margarine, some use stock cubes and some not, of course. Yes.
And that could be looked at different social backgrounds and
also different
projects.
Yes.
So, I mean, I ask sort of, even when you say... there's a difference between what people eat and what is projected in the cookery books.
Mm-hmm.
Again, I mean, I don't know what data you're using to show that. Do you have national statistic data about what people are eating? Or
no, I just did some observation for 3 years in Malta, going to different cuisines, you know, and I listen to what people say, and also I, you know, ask them clearly what did they eat this week. Because if I just say...
So you have a record of what a number of people have been eating
yes.
by different social categories.
And timpana is quite present, for example.
Mm-hmm.
But sopa talamla, I mean, you know...
It's rare.
It's rare. And it is really something emblematic. Mm-hmm. Hobbs bezeit, for example, is still prepared, not cooked, prepared, but in very different ways, with more kind of soft... you know, kind of hot dog bread.
Mm-hmm.
I want to come back to what you said before. I mean, in anthropology, we know that it's not because people don't have consciously the project of creating a national food which looks like a Mediterranean imaginary. They are not consciously doing it. The fact is that they have this bias. They have this idea that Maltese food is like that. They have this bias that it's rural, that it's family-oriented, you know.
So thank you very much for a very provocative talk.
Thanks.
You have just listened to a talk in the Work in Progress seminar series entitled Cookery Books and Maltese National Ideology. This talk was delivered by Elise Biard, lecturer in material culture in the Anthropology Division and PhD candidate at the University of Provence.